You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Martha Plimpton in today for Leonard Lopate. Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory have been collaborating for 40 years now on film, in theaters, and those of us who love the movie My Dinner with Andre hope over long, lingering dinner conversations. In honor of their partnership, the Public Theater and Theater for a New Audience have joined forces to stage the Wallace Shawn Andre Gregory Project. The first production, Shawn's The Designated Mourner, is playing at the Public Theater through August 25th. Wallace Shawn both wrote and acts in the play, which is directed by Andre Gregory, and I am so thrilled that it brings them here today. Welcome.
Well, I'm thrilled to see you because you were last my daughter.
That's right.
In a Peter Weir movie.
That's right, in the Mosquito Coast many years ago. I was 15 when we first met and worked together.
Unbelievable.
It was an incredible experience. We shot that movie in the jungles of Belize.
And what was I, 18?
Yes, you were. I think you were 18 or maybe 22.
Maybe 22.
Yeah, closer to 22. How did you two meet, speaking of meeting, original meetings?
Oh, that's a long story.
Well, there are many sides to that story, but I'll tell my version of it. Well, the writer, Renata Adler, was a mutual friend, and she encouraged me very, very strongly to go to see Andre's company do his production of Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
And for several years I'd been writing plays and showing them to people who I hoped might appreciate them.
Mm-hmm.
But in every case, there was a disappointing result.
Right.
No one in the professional theater or even most of my friends or people that I would meet in any way appreciated my plays. But anyway, seeing that play, Alice in Wonderland, we would have to literally say changed my life, obviously, or I wouldn't be here. And
Andre, obviously you responded differently than everyone else had to Wally's work.
Wally sent me about, what, 9 plays? A lot of plays.
All at once?
Yeah, all at once that had never been done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going around the house reading them and going, oh, my God, this is amazing. This is amazing. I just couldn't believe there was writing like that. Yeah,
wow.
I was stunned from the beginning.
So I read in the New York Times, it was recently an article about you two, that your first collaboration was Our Late Night, which was about a Manhattan cocktail party. And when I hear the people in the audience at that production mooed their disapproval.
Oh, they didn't just mood. One person got up and hit Larry Pine, one of the actors in the production. Oh, yeah.
It must have been in one of these famously small venues in which you perform, yes?
No.
Oh, no.
No, it was actually at the Public Theater in one of their larger theaters. And one of the peculiar things about the play was that, there's a wonderful comic device in the play, which is that people actually say what very often they're thinking.
Right.
So a man meets an attractive woman at a cocktail party, and they start to talk about Obama. So the subtext was the text.
Right.
And when the play got reviewed, the people who read the review sort of misunderstood the play, a lot of them.
Mm.
And I think they were people that thought they were going to a 42nd Street porno house. So when they saw this play,
okay,
that was really serious,
they really were, obviously they were very taken aback
and disappointed.
Okay.
Some of them, wouldn't you say?
Well, I don't know why, but we We did have a larger audience when we began.
Mm-hmm.
And after, as I remember it, after about 10 days, it dwindled to the point where the actors had to say, well, if there are more of them than there are of us,
right,
we'll do it.
We'll do it.
But it did get great reviews.
I believe. Yeah. And did you use similar – did you draw on those same sort of – things for Marie and Bruce, which happens to be, I know, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think it may be my favorite of all your plays. But there are a lot of hilarious cocktail party scenes in Marie and Bruce.
My writing process is, you know, hard. I can't describe it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't describe it.
Do you think Andre is a better interpreter of your writing process as a director than you can be as the writer?
Well, he has to be, right, really, because he has been entrusted with inevitably interpreting what is written on the page and putting it into a form that is manageable for the human brain.
One of the most interesting or remarkable elements of your relationship is how eagerly and intently you two seem to listen to each other. And we saw that in My Dinner with Andre. Do you ever get bored with each other or get exasperated with listening to it? You've been doing it after 40 years. Do you find yourself sort of like a married couple at a certain point?
Well, it depends on the married couple.
Right.
I never get bored listening to my wife.
That's lucky.
And I have to say I have never for a second been bored by a single rehearsal. Mm-hmm. Of Wally's plays.
Well, we don't actually talk much.
No, we don't.
And our rehearsal process involves less talk mm-hmm. than anybody else's rehearsal process.
Yet you rehearse probably more, well, not probably, definitely more than the average production would rehearse.
Oh, to say the least.
Yes.
I mean, but part of the there's, for most of the plays that we've done, there's been very little sitting around a table or talking about, well, what's really going on in this scene in the abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the discoveries that we make are on our feet, really. Mm-hmm. Abstract analysis of the play is very rare, although with The Designated Mourner, we did a certain amount of it because it seemed to Andre necessary. But we're not having long, boring discussions during rehearsal.
Right. What is the concept, let's say, just to draw a broad stroke, of The Designated Mourner? Who is that person? Andre? Wally? Who wants to pick that?
Well, the first thing that comes into my mind is that Wally describes himself, the character, mm-hmm. at one point as a rat. I would say on one level, he is representative of the millions of people in this country who are watching us plunge towards fascism and are not saying anything or care so much about, like people in the McCarthy period.
Sure.
I think it's very mm-hmm. similar. They cared so much about their jobs and their comforts that they would actually betray people who were close to them. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think he's the character, the people out there now who are so indifferent to, I think, terrifying things happening in this country now,
right,
that they just stay on their cell phones and play around.
The ones who are able to sort of if not avoid, at least evade the consequences of the revolution, whether the revolution is for good or for ill, basically.
Definitely. I mean, what would you say, Wall?
Well, I would subscribe to everything Andre said. The character that I play is someone who cares about survival above everything else. You could say he's a physical coward who doesn't want to be physically hurt. Or you could say, as one of the other characters says about him, that he's lazy. Cowardice is, in a way, a form of laziness. And the guy does represent, I must say, and certainly as we're doing it now, I feel every night that it is an attack on us. And I'm including somebody like myself. I mean, Bradley Manning is courageous, and Snowden is courageous, and if we really had the guts, we would all be, where they are, in prison or fugitives or God knows what. I mean, the things that are happening are evil. And, most of us are either afraid or too lazy to do anything about it. And that, I must say, is exactly what Jack, the rather amusing and delightful character who I play, is like.
Mm-hmm. You have a history of creating a sort of slow burn around your work in terms of the audience's entrances and exits to the theater. They become, in that sense, part of the atmosphere, part of the world in which you're making this work.
Oh, the audience is always implicated.
Right.
It's always clear this could be about you as well as about us.
And is that why you choose to wait until the end of the show, wait until the end of the piece for people to receive their programs from Wally as they leave?
No. My idea about that was that, one of the central themes of my dinner with Andre is the danger of habit.
Right.
And how habit lures us to sleep, and that you have to be awake to the world around you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I just hate about theater in general is, you go into the same old place, you're given a program, you read who everybody is.
Ritual and all that.
Yeah, and you start falling asleep mentally. Mm-hmm. While people who come into the theater, they expect their programs, they don't get them. They get sometimes somewhat annoyed, sometimes intrigued, but they wake up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Andre, you, speaking of keeping people on their toes, you tend to rehearse plays for many, many years sometimes, sometimes 14, 15 years.
Yeah.
With no final performance in sight. How long did you rehearse? For example, you did this with Uncle Vanya. How long did you work on Uncle Vanya before you actually even committed it to film when you eventually did?
Was it about 4 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we work on things.
Right. Rather than rehearse.
Yes.
That's good. Yeah, no, I think that makes sense because rehearse suggests you're sort of reiterating something over and over again. Whereas
And rehearse implies a production that we've been hired to do.
Right.
When actually these are just, in a way, the line is blurred between whether this is our life or whether this is professional.
Well, my wife made a wonderful film on my life and work called Before and After Dinner, which
That's
was
right.
mm-hmm. out in New York and is around the country. For her, it's completely natural to work for 3 or 4 years on a film. I have friends who are novelists who work for a decade. So this whole concept of having to rehearse a play in a month is purely economic.
Right.
It has nothing to do with
And frustrating to actors as well. I mean, people sometimes assume that actors can't imagine, being stuck with something for that long. But actually, there's true pleasure in it, in being able to commit for that long to a process like that.
Particularly if you're working in depth.
Yes. Well, of course. I mean, if you're working for 3 weeks on, a play, there's no way to work in depth, is there?
No, and Wally's plays for me are like, the work of composers such as Berlioz or Shostakovich. They're difficult works.
Right.
My job is to make them accessible to the audience. But to think that you can crack a play like that.
Right. Do they ever really get cracked, really? You originally worked on The Designated Mourner, or at least first performed it in 2000. It's now 13 years later. What are the new cracks that you found?
It's much clearer, wouldn't mm-hmm. you say?
Oh, yes. This production is... I feel each detail is much sharper and clearer, and the whole thing is very hard to evade. I mean, the play really does take place in the mind of the spectator mm-hmm. in a way that is not true of all plays. I mean, we're presenting them with conflicting and contradictory stories that they have to make sense of. And, I mean, if they don't, the whole thing is kind of meaningless.
Right.
They can't just watch it unfold mm-hmm. because there are a lot of contradictions between what I am telling them and what they're being told by the character of my wife in the play. Mm-hmm. She's telling them things that don't fit with what I'm telling them. So if they just sit there passively waiting, following it, I don't know what it even means.
So do you think now, in 2013, after all of this, we've had the longest war in our history, and do you think there's less of a political response or even political activism now than when you first performed the show 13 years ago?
Oh, I think when we first performed it, there was no political activism. I don't think people even knew there were any problems in the world, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that the play was more puzzling mm-hmm. to a lot of people.
Back then.
They said, for instance, wow, there's a lot of violence in your play. What does that symbolize? Mm-hmm. Now, nobody is saying that today.
It's funny. The person, my date that I went to see the show with, didn't realize that it had been performed before and thought it was a new work and was curious to know if it was perhaps about Syria. It has that kind of immediacy to it, is what I'm saying. There are questions of revolution and also, tyrannical revolution as well in the work. And you come back to things like that quite often in your work, in The Fever as well. What do you feel like is the audience now, I guess you're saying they are, they're more primed for it now, to hear it now?
Well, I mean, the audience in the year 2000 didn't realize, for the most part, that the United States is hated mm-hmm. in a lot of the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world, and why that would be the case. So when the character talks about how there are these people out there who don't like us, people were kind of not even sure what in the world I was talking about. And now, boy,
yeah,
people are very well aware of what I'm talking about.
He said ominously. Go ahead.
Every night I sort of meet and greet the audience. Mm-hmm. And there was this lovely young man who came in, was delighted to meet me, and he smiled and he said, our smiling guide through the apocalypse.
That's wonderful. So many of your plays have been performed to very small audiences, very small, sometimes only invited guests, really. Does it matter to you how many people you ultimately reach with your work? Or do you keep it small because you feel that that's the best way to experience the work?
Well, I think it's the best way to experience the work, A, if the audience is going to feel in any way implicated or that it could be about them.
I see.
And B, also, I went to see, and it was a revelation, I went to see a very good Ibsen play on Broadway, and I was sitting in the fourth row of the theater, and it seemed, of the orchestra, and it seemed as if the actors were a mile away from me, because film and TV have changed our ways of perception. We look at everything in close-up. So I also like the audience to be close. But I had dinner with a very prominent Broadway producer, and she said to me, "Don't you get fed up with your plays always reaching such small audiences?" And I said, "Well, you know, one work turned into my dinner with Andre, one into Vanya on 42nd Street, another into this film that's coming out, Fear of Falling, directed by Jonathan Demme." In other words, our work has begun for very, very small audiences, and that's the way I like to do it in the theater. But it has reached quite large audiences.
I'm Martha Plimpton, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Wally Shawn and Andre Gregory. I always want to call you Wally. Your name's always written Wallace, but it's impossible for me to call you Wallace. I don't know. I've known you as Wally for so many years. Does that bother you? Do you care?
Well, since the death of my mother, it doesn't, you know, really matter in a certain way. She tried to believe in me as a serious figure, a battle that was lost sort of in the 5-year-old class. I would be upset if I would think you were my mother if you called me Wallace.
Well, heaven forfend. And actually, and you're a very funny man anyway. I mean, the plays that you write are, of course, very serious. I think their subjects are quite serious, but there's always, an undercurrent isn't the right word, but you always use humor. If it's to give the audience a little bit of a moment to breathe so that they're, you know, sometimes when you're breathing, you can let more information in when you're taking those big, hearty laughs.
Well, I personally, as a director, always feel extremely uncomfortable if the audience isn't laughing.
Right.
And I know that not every audience laughs, but Wally's plays are, as you say, very, very funny, as well as being deeply serious. And when I work on them, I'm always hoping the audience will laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's only very unusual writers are humorless. I mean, some of the most serious writers are quite funny if you are prepared to actually read them. Noam Chomsky has a wonderful, bitter, ironic humor, and Karl Marx also had a very, very tart, very ironic sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the word humor means, and I don't know how to define it, and most people could not define it.
Right.
And so that's just how I've always been. Mm-hmm. I mean, since I could talk, I think.
Well, I also find Wally one of the funniest individuals that I've ever met, and I save his messages on my phone machine.
Do you?
Yeah.
You should put them together in a collection, make a piece of theater out of them. That would be really good. Your next production in this series is going to be Grasses of a Thousand Colors, which has been performed in New York it's never been performed in New York.
No.
So what's that going to
– We did it at the Royal Court in London.
Okay. Will you give a brief description of that work? Is it possible? Can you give a brief description of that work?
Well, maybe Andre can. We could say that it describes the operation of the universe.
That's easy to understand.
To be more specific than that is really difficult. It has a lot to do with nature, mm-hmm. as that used to be called, or the environment, as it's called mm-hmm. today. And there are people in it and animals.
Is there a man in it who thinks he can solve global warming by teaching people to eat their own, to cannibalize each other? Is there some cannibalism in there?
No.
I'm just grabbing at clues, any clue I can find.
Yeah, I mean, it does, there is a man in it who has invented a nutrient for animals that he has introduced into the world.
I really need to see this, I think, in order to understand. It certainly sounds, and it also, by the way, Wally, sounds hilarious.
Oh, it is. It is. It's screamingly funny.
Oh, I'm so excited. And was it well received? And I imagine it was incredibly well received in London, yeah?
Well, I think it was. I never read reviews, so I'm not sure.
Good.
I would say that we had, there were people who received it joyfully, and others, since you ask,
yeah.
not everyone yeah. was as joyful as
right.
the most joyful people.
But there's nothing wrong with that, right?
I mean, it is. It's a very unusual play. I would,
and you'll act in it as well, won't you?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, I can promise you that you have never seen anything like this.
I actually can believe you.
This one is really unusual.
I can believe you. We have a link to the WNYC radio production of The Designated Mourner on the Leonard Lopate show page at WNYC.org. I've been speaking with Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn, the greats, about The Designated Mourner, which is playing at the Public Theater through August 25th. I've seen it, and you really must see it. It's really special and wonderful. Ticket information is available on the Leonard Lopate show page at WNYC.org. Wally, Andre, it's been a huge pleasure having you. I love you both so much. I don't see you enough. Seeing you in here was kind of weird, but also kind of fun, wasn't it?
It was great.
Good.
And you're such a great host.
Yes,
well,
you're
you.
Terrific.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, guys. Coming up next, psychoanalyst Jameson Webster and professor of philosophy Simon Critchley discuss why Shakespeare's Hamlet still reverberates in our culture.
Wow.
I'm Martha Plimpton. I know, right? Sounds interesting. I'm Martha Plimpton, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org.